snow paved. My house burned. I lost everything. Didn't have insurance. Mm-hmm. I have a seizure disorder. I'm blind in my left eye. I can't drive because of that. And lost everything in a house fire. And was just basically sleeping along railroad tracks, getting drunk. And I landed in Kansas City, homeless, shirt on my back. Stayed at several of the missions and was scared to death. I mean, these are intimidating places, especially for a white boy that knew nothing about living on the street in a big city. And so I hooked up with a bunch of homeless guys that were just living in parks, living in woods, living along railroad tracks and stuff. And one of them kept telling me about this place called the Shower House. And I was thinking, you know, along the lines of the missions, where the showers are scary places, they're mm-hmm. filthy, that much crud, and et cetera, and I wouldn't go, which is ironic. And finally, he showed up one morning and said, come on, you're going, here's a bus pass. And it was about 40 blocks from where I was camping out here. And came through that door, when they opened, and I immediately felt at home. It was a whole different experience than other soup kitchens, other food pantries and stuff I'd been to. I was immediately treated like a human being. And I said, no, this feels like home. And to sit down, have breakfast on a real plate, coffee in a real cup, and clean showers, clean clothes. And so I started coming back. And I was in kind of a routine. I'd walk about 140 blocks every day, just to get three square meals, a shower, and clean clothes, and then get back to a place that was safe to sleep. Mm-hmm. And just kept doing it, and one morning I was waiting out here. It was chilly. I remember that. It was cold. And one of the members stuck their head out and said, we're short of help. Could somebody wash dishes? And looked right at me. Well, sure, you know. And that was when I started volunteering here. And I did that for a year. And eventually learned all the stations in here, how to do everything when Jareth Brook is open. And it was Christmas a year ago. I had fallen on the ice and hurt my back really bad, carrying groceries back to the abandoned house I lived in. And I stayed down for about 2 days, and when I got up, I could hardly walk, and it was frostbite. I had some really severe frostbite on my feet, and it happened to be a Thursday, so I stumbled over here. They have community dinner on Thursday, and came in, and, well, what's up, you know, of course, by then I knew everyone, and ate dinner, and at the end of it, they all took me aside and said, you know, we want you to just move in for a little while until your feet are better, and okay, you know, so I moved into a room right here, right next to where I stay now, and, soon afterwards, they had a new intern come in. He was a Jesuit novice, and this was part of his training, was, you know, to do something like this, do works of mercy. And we became really close friends. This guy's 24 years old, and just as enthusiastic as could be, completely changed my old perception of what a Jesuit was, became very, very interested what he was doing, and he encouraged me to apply for internship. First, it's like before, I didn't think they would take me. I thought, you know, I'm a drunk off the street, and so I waited for a few weeks, and then finally asked for an application, and everybody's attitude was, what took you so long? and so I interviewed with the Covenant members here, and answered a lot of hard questions about, you know, really where I was with faith. And it came clear to me that God had put me here for a reason, that this was not accidental. And all this time out on the street with the homelessness, with the alcohol, with the drugs, with the people out there, I had been doing that for a reason too, and this is the reason. I know what it's like on the other side of that door. And that's really formed the basis of my faith right there. I call it a moment of an epiphany where it just suddenly became clear that God was working. And I was growing in ways that I couldn't on my own.
Right.
And I'm still growing. But It is not me that's doing the growth. It's God that's changing me from within. Mm-hmm. It's down on a subconscious level. I'm aware that something very powerful is happening in my life. I'm not privy to all the details, but I do get these aha moments when things come clearer. This is why this is happening. I'm seeing a psychotherapist now for depression, which has dogged me all my life. They're trying some antidepressants, but actually I'm moving to the point that I hardly need them now. Mm-hmm. I do go to AA. I have a sponsor. I'm working a 12-step program, and I'm really enthusiastic about that. It's really made a big difference in my life. And mostly, it is just Jareth Brooke is it. I feel closer to God here than I ever can imagine. This forms the base. I still spend a lot of time out on the street, mm-hmm. with the homeless. I still have a lot of friends out there. I don't hang out with them, obviously, like I used to. I don't go out and drink with them. I don't go out and get high with them. But I do keep in contact, and I encourage them to come in. I encourage them to follow some of the path that I have. I've learned how to jump through the hoops with the system, getting people food stamps, getting people housing, getting people SSI, getting them off the streets. And I also have done a lot of work like with City Hall. There is an ordinance that just came through that did not pass that was going to regulate the food trucks that feed the homeless. Okay, well, it all, on the surface, it looked like a good thing. And it came down to, okay, we're going to regulate them to make sure nobody gets foodborne illness and et cetera. And I think that's great. Yeah. And we're going to regulate them to make sure trash from, doesn't pile up. I think that's great. Mm-hmm. But the actual intention behind it was very, very different. It was basically, there were some nice neighborhoods here in the Northeast where the homeless were camping back in the woods. And last winter, when the leaves fell, well, winter before last, those camps became visible, and the people in those million-dollar homes were not at all happy. Mm-hmm. And so they started this push. And they pushed so hard that the police came down and raided the camps, destroyed their camps. And so they were out at a time of the year when they were the most vulnerable. And talk about some righteous anger. I should know better. I was angry. I mean, pushed me out of my home. Maybe I can forgive, but it was really, really hard for me to forgive that.
Yeah.
Because those people had no place to go, and they had lost their blankets, their tents, and everything. And so,
it's horrible.
Yeah.
Back to the beginning. Something I didn't catch on tape. Where were you born and when were you born?
I was born in Nevada, Missouri, mm-hmm. 1957, 56.
Okay.
It's kind of a lower middle class family, an extended family that really ran the gauntlet from very tolerant to very, very racist. My first stepfather's family was just incredibly racist. But interestingly enough, my grandfather on that side, he worked out at the old Bendix plant here where, eventually they produced nuclear weapons parts, and now there's the new plant. And he, after he worked there in the 50s, he had illness, and I'm certain that's why, from breathing in the beryllium and all the heavy metals and stuff. And so I've got a personal stake in peacemaking here.
Right.
Not only I don't think we need, our world needs any more nuclear weapons. It doesn't need any more people getting sick making the parts for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I'm on the front line out there with the protests. Mm-hmm. I haven't crossed the line yet, but I have. The reason why was not that I was afraid to cross the line and afraid to go to jail for my convictions, it's that our membership here was, we were down to 4 adults,
mm-hmm.
and we actually had to cut back on our hours, and if I was in jail, it would be a lot harder on my family here, but it would be on me instead of Dale's self.
Yeah. Were you raised in a religious home?
Like I said, my religion went about lip deep. My great grandmother was very religious and very sincere about it. She belonged to the Methodist Church, and I went to a little country Methodist church that was on a circuit. The pastor would preach at three different churches on a Sunday, and then the last one would he preach to, he'd go home with someone for dinner, and that was part of his salary. And then growing up, I had an intense love of music, which was encouraged. I took pipe organ lessons, and later went to Central Methodist College and the conservatory there. But it was for the music, not for the faith. The faith never ran true with me. Eventually, I became pretty agnostic, almost to the point of atheism. I don't think I ever quite went that far, but I came close. And actually, hitting the streets here with nothing but my entire possessions in a plastic bag, and I was sleeping in Washington Park, which is right next to Crown Center. It's kind of between Crown Center, the Liberty Memorial, and Union Station there, just a small park. And after my bad experience, it was actually at City Union Mission, I swore I will never go back to there. And I was just walking around aimlessly thinking, well, you know, what am I going to do now? No money. Hardly the shoes I've got on my feet are falling apart. I'm going to be eating out of dumpsters, I guess. But I didn't know about a lot of the soup kitchens and stuff. And I walked through Washington Park. There was a light rain falling, and I was just miserable. This was, I think, about the 1st of September, 2 years, three, 4 years ago now. Has it been that long? And as I'm walking through the park, up comes this guy, and he's pulling one of those suitcases on wheels and walks right up to me and said, "Are you homeless?" "I'm homeless, too." "Well, yeah, I am." He said, "That's all right." He said, "Sit down. There's going to be some other guys show up here." And one of them showed up with a little Primus stove and made coffee. And we sat under the link to get out of the rain, had a cup of coffee, and talked. And I started hanging with him. And within a few days, I knew about the food trucks. I knew how to find food. They had got me down to Catholic Charities. I had a blanket of my own. They had gotten me the library. I had a library card. Was back on the internet. And it was just like, wow, you know. We just camped right there in the park under the trees. That was where we lived. At that time, the police were not running people out of that area. They are now. And it was like late one night. It was just like it was strange. It had been a strange day. It had been raining again, and at the end of it, there had been a double rainbow, the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. They were setting up for the Irish Fest, and they were testing the sound system, and they put a song that I was familiar with. It was from Rush, called "Something for Nothing," and it actually spoke about looking at the rainbow's end to find that pot of gold. And this is right when that rainbow came out. And I just had this rushy feeling in me, like something's changing inside of me. It was almost like being on LSD. It was just that kind of a, doing it to me whether I want to or not. And I was like, oh, what is going on in my life? You know, this is basically the end. I'm on the street. I have no prospects, no way to find a job, no way to get a job here. And so late that night, it must have been like 2 o'clock in the morning, listening to the trains go by, just right there. And I look around, and here everybody's asleep on their blanket. I was right by the trash can. I still can mark the spot. I got down on my knees and prayed. The first time in my adult life, I truly prayed. I said, "God, is this all there's going to be in my life? What do I do next?" And this feeling of peace came on me, and I looked around, and I saw those guys laying there on their blankets, and I knew right then what I was going to do. I was going to help them. presence of God has never left me since that moment.
Wow. That's a powerful story. So all that led you to living here at Cherith Brook. And how do you feel like living here has changed the way you live your faith?
I can no longer hold this to myself, all of this in. Mm-hmm. For one thing, you know, I lost all my possessions. I don't regret that.
Mm-hmm.
None of it. And I could lose everything, you know, what little possessions I have here. I could lose it again right now, and I wouldn't regret it.
Mm-hmm.
I could give it away, but I wouldn't regret it. Anything I own. Everything that is placed in my hands is ultimately God's.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't immediately need it, I need to be gifting it to someone who does. And, that's a profound change in the way I've lived my life. I don't mind admitting to anyone that without God I am nothing. Every time I try to take my life in my hands, take the wheel in my hands to drive, I'm going to make a mess of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even. But of course I still do. I backslide and I'm like, oh gosh, I'd like this, and I put myself in this. And then sooner or later down the line, I'll realize the error of my ways. God will show me the error of my ways, because
mm-hmm.
it is not about me. It's about we.
Yeah.
We here, my family at Cherith Brook, we, the human race, and God has so little of me just to walk humbly with Him and love my fellow man. And that's really all. When I judge, I know I shouldn't, but I do, we all do judge. I judge any person two criteria. How do they treat me and how do they treat others?
Mm-hmm.
Not by the color of their skin, not by how much money they contribute, not by anything else. It is a matter of, are they treating themselves right? Are they treating those around them right? It's a new philosophy. I would put that philosophy here. Two philosophies, actually. First of all, have I learned more about myself and the world than I knew yesterday? And how can I help relieve someone suffering?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really it. That covers it all. Just look at those. And this is an evolving thing with me. It's never been static since that first moment of epiphany that started me down this path. My awareness, my contact with God evolves, grows. Sometimes it'll seem like my prayers just go dry for a period of time. You know, it's like I'm praying, and I'm not getting answers, and then it just comes in a rush. I think God was, you know, flipping the switches inside,
yeah.
saying, you know, we've got to get you ready inside before you can know it up here. You have
mm-hmm.
to know it here first.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so true. That if I follow my head, I'm always going to be driving off a cliff. But if I follow my heart, then things work out. Admission of my own sins, confession of sins, has become part of my life. Owning up to my own mistakes promptly, really, you know, when I make a mistake, it's not a matter of, I used to keep a pen of scapegoats out in the back, you know, it was like, I could almost run them out on eBay, but now it's like, you know, I make a mistake, I slip occasionally, but I try to, you know, take responsibility for my own mistakes, because I know the sooner that I do, the easier it's going to be to fix what I've done wrong.
Right.
And that has come about. And living here, the commune itself has given me a feeling I've never had in life, and that is I know, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that everyone here loves me for who I am.
Yeah.
And they care about my welfare. This is not something that I ever, ever have to doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And that alone just makes personal spiritual growth so much easier. I'm not having to bang my head up against a closed mind, a closed heart all the time. You know, when someone here asks me, how are you doing today? I know that they generally want the answer. They want the truth. And they're not just asking that to get their head rattled. You know, they're generally interested in how I am. Mm-hmm. And I am in them. So, yeah. Our peace works, of course, is important. Our hospitality, that is first here.
Mm-hmm.
Service, works of charity. And going green. Obviously, our gardens speak for themselves. In 8 years, Charlottesburg has never had to tap into city water for its gardens. We save water runoff in cisterns and above ground tanks.
Mm-hmm.
We raise chickens, which are the ultimate in personal garbage disposal units, and they give us back eggs and they mm-hmm. give us back meat. And we all take a hand. We all take our turns in the gardens, raising the chickens, the beehives. This is only our third year with beehives. The first year they got a couple of pints.
Mm-hmm.
Last summer we got 15 gallons. And
wow.
We were sticky for a week harvesting it. But that was just amazing. We have a wood stove here we put in last year, and we're going to put two more in before winter comes, maybe three if we can swing mm-hmm. it. And we get a lot of firewood donated, so that helps with the heating bill. We have solar panels on the roof here. 60% of the power here comes from solar, 100% green.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a project to put in a DC circuit from additional solar panels for water pumping,
mm-hmm.
so we don't have to carry 5-gallon buckets to water our gardens from the cisterns.
Right.
And so, we have a bicycle shop. We rebuild bicycles and give them away to people that need them.
Mm-hmm.
And, it is a full-time job living here, but at the same time, I'm moving to the point now where I feel like, yeah, I can handle a part-time job, someplace between 10 and 20 hours a week. I am not a covenanted member. At the time that, last year when it came down, I was very close to getting in, I was engaged and getting close to marriage, which did not work out. The guy and I split up. He's got his own problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not covenant. And I had a really, really difficult time at that. And again, the community was right there beside me
mm-hmm.
the whole time through it, which could have really, really destroyed my life, what I was going through. And now I've come through it. I'm stronger than ever. I have some new boundaries in place with relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as my drug and alcohol recovery, my sessions with my therapist for the depression, and the psychotropic drugs that I'm trying for the depression, I have 100% support here.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that is contributing to my recovery, they are behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you can't put a price on that. Because
right.
I had tried to get off of drugs before, but I still had my original, my family, and their attitude was, it's just a matter of willpower.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people still think it is. It's like, if I had had terminal cancer and was struggling with it through the chemotherapy, et cetera, they'd have done everything they can. But alcoholism and drug addiction in general is so inclusive. It's not only a disease of a single person, it's a disease of everyone that their lives touch. And my family was not strong enough to cope with that.
Mm-hmm.
They just couldn't. Whereas here, we cope with it all the time. Every day we're open, we have alcoholics, practicing alcoholics, drug addicts, pimps, prostitutes, losers, winners, dealers, you name it, they're coming through the door all the time. And at first they were afraid, isn't this going to trigger you? I said, no, I can't run away from it. No matter where I go, there I am.
Mm-hmm.
The disease is going to go with me. I have to meet it head on. I have to meet it on its own terms. And it actually helps when you do this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
and we do a lot of it. There are a lot of people that this is the place of last resort. People coming in detoxing that are obviously need medical attention, mm-hmm. which is something that we're glad to do. Mm-hmm. We'll get them into detox units. I've been there. I've been there with all of it. And I can spot it, and believe me, I can empathize. Mm-hmm. When I see some person stagger in, shaking, I say, they're on the edge of DTs. We need to get them help now. Get them on some Librium, get them in a controlled environment. It's obvious. I've been in intensive care for it more than once, more times than I'd like to remember. But nonetheless, I do remember, and it helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. So you said that when you first came to Cherith Brook, you felt like they were actually seeing you, and that you hadn't felt that way in other charity programs or other aid programs. What do you think is the difference?
Part of it is just that we try to see Jesus incognito in mm-hmm. everyone. We try to see Jesus in you. But most of all, I can see Jesus in the poor, the homeless, the destitute, the outcast, which Jesus was. He was homeless too. He was in trouble with the authorities. He was beloved by the poor. And it's an amazing thing. No matter. A lot of people that come in here are in a bad space. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've been, our camp was raided last night. Maybe someone came in and stole from them. Maybe it was cold and they had no place to get warm. It was raining and so they were wet and cold. And maybe they couldn't get to another food kitchen for supper, so they're coming in hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe their last pair of shoes fell apart on the way here. These are people that are on the edge of life, and no matter what their mood, I realize that's Christ looking back at them from those eyes.
Mm.
I'm going to do what I can. And the greatest gift of all is mine. God gives the secondary gift to me in this that is just beyond compare. It's an empowerment. It's a strength of faith, a depth of faith that I could not experience doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, even if I got a job and decided, perhaps that I would move out and perhaps get married someday or something. And I don't rule those out. But I cannot imagine life without doing this kind of work. Because this is where I live. This is my life. Anything else, that's just secondary.
Yeah.
And if I was ever to find a mate, a soulmate, they would have to understand that. They would actually have to be a part of this, or they would not be a soulmate.
Yeah.
I would not say that this life, that everybody is cut out for this life, although I believe, I certainly have faith that everyone could come in tune with it if they so desired. But this is not practice. This is not reading about it. This is not debating it in college course. This is the real thing. This happens every day, every moment, every second of my life. This is where I am. And it's so refreshing. It's just like once I hit on that rhythm, it's like 30 years fell off. 30 years of anxiety, 30 years of despair just evaporated. And just like morning mist, it just lifted from me. And now it's like it is an ultimate in not being self-conscious about who I am and what I'm doing. I take pride in showing off my family here, saying, yeah, I'm part of this, and I feel like God has put us on the front line for a reason. That's who we are.
Can you tell me more about the family here? How many? You said at one point there were only four.
Okay, there were four adults. When I moved in, there were, let's see, there were two, three, four, five, six, seven, nine of us. Ten of us was Sean. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was the novice. The Garbisons are man and wife. They live up the upstairs apartment, and they have two teenage children.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved in, there was Allison, who lives upstairs. She is an RN. There was Elizabeth, who worked at a restaurant. There was Josh, who worked as a youth minister at a church, who later married Elizabeth, and they moved to Sweden. And there was Nick, and Nick just has a lot of jobs. Nick moved out last summer, and he's engaged. He's going to be married here in just a few weeks, and he's gone now. And we've had people come and go that will intern for a while, for a month, sometimes 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Melanie and Caleb are here just on intern. Melanie's leaving tomorrow. She's been here a month. Caleb just came last week. He's staying a month.
Mm-hmm.
And then last week we had Theo and Nicole, who were their husband and wife. They came and stayed for a month. And they're discerning whether they're going to their families. They're going to spend a month with their family. And they're discerning whether to actually join the covenant here.
Right.
I have thought about doing so too, to actually join the covenant, which would be a year's commitment.
Mm-hmm.
But I have way big medical bills right now.
Mm-hmm.
From the times I ended up in intensive care, DTs and seizures and et cetera, and we're talking several hundred thousand dollars in medical bills.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just saying, okay, I refuse to let the community take any responsibility for any of that, so I cannot be on the checking account. You know? So, you know, but that's actually not a problem, you know, with it. I am an exceptional case in that I am the first person that has ever actually joined here that came off the street that was homeless.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real significance in that fact. I just happened to be the first. I was the first person to ever ask.
Yeah.
And so that's where I stand with that. So I'm kind of like more than a guest, but less than a full member.
Right.
In that, you know, because of my financial status, you know, I don't have direct control of the checking account, which is no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
This place is about trust. As a matter of fact, no one owns Jarethburg. It is all in a trust.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a board of trustees, some of whom are members here, and some of them are former members here, and some of whom are just really good friends. So, and matter of fact, Sunday we'll have a trustee meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not trustees in a corporate sense at all. Instead, they are very knowledgeable sounding board. So if we were to make any major financial decisions, we would obviously want to run it by them and, you know, do a lot of, and we've got more people praying and meditating about, you know, seeing clear to an answer. And I attend, with my status, I will still attend the trustee meeting. I do not have a vote because, you know, I'm not in the covenant, but it's no big deal. And I pointed out, and everyone agrees, that if I make a good argument, I don't need to vote anyway. We do everything by consensus. Once a week, we have what we call our agenda meeting. It's always Wednesday morning, and that's absolutely mandatory. All of us have to be there, and we go over everything, absolutely everything that concerns us personally, concerns us as a community, concerns us with our interaction with other communities. I say we do the week, we do the month, we do the years ahead, anything and everything. And it's an amazing process. I've been in a lot of committees and et cetera, doing things like this with Robert's Rules, the parliamentarian, et cetera. And we can do in 5 minutes what, you know, what most committees can do in a year. It's just because we know each other so well, we're on such intimate terms with each other that we pretty much know how we're going to react before we even ask.
Right.
And so, yeah. And it's very much a faith-based decision-making process. Mm-hmm. Quite often, if we don't come to agreement, we'll just say, okay, let's pray about it for a while. Mm-hmm. It always works out. It always does. We are celebrating next month. The loan on all of the property will be paid off. Mm-hmm. This will be free and clear. This was purchased with an interest-free loan. Mm-hmm. We won't owe anyone anything. That's a huge celebration for us. As a matter of fact, we're going to celebrate that Sunday at our trustee meeting, basically. Mm-hmm. That's been my project for today. I'm making elaborate desserts. And that's another part of it that, I learned to cook practically as a child. And I haven't used it for years. It was always fast food or out of a dumpster for the earth class. And now I don't even think twice about cooking for 60, 100 people. You know, we have 4 complete kitchens. And if I gear up, I'll have all of them going.
That's a lot of work. It's a lot of planning.
It's a lot of fun, though, because almost everything we do, if possible, we do together.
Mm.
We cook together. We pray together. We eat together. We don't just talk about being a community, we gel as a community.
Yeah.
And we all have our own unique talents and skills, of which, you know, I knew how to do electrical work, I knew how to do plumbing, I worked as a manager for rental properties for a long time. And it's not that a matter, okay, I automatically become Mr. Fix-It. Instead, while I'm doing the fixing, I'm teaching others to do it.
Right.
And everyone else has their skills. Like Allison, you know, but she's an RN. She is over several group homes and stuff. And in terms of first aid and et cetera, which we really need skills like that. I'm a CNA, but I've got a lot to learn. And, you know, she's teaching me. She's teaching others her skills, computer skills. Public speaking is something that I was terrified of, and Eric, who is an ordained Presbyterian minister and truly our spokesman, he is our voice, he's coached me a lot, and now I go to student meetings with the city manager here, and it doesn't bother me a bit anymore. I try to become the voice of those who have no voice out there. I needed a strong voice to do that, and I'm growing into it, you know. Like, I don't back away and go through anxiety attacks anymore at having to do things like that. Bring it on.
So do you all have pretty much the same beliefs about Christianity? Or, because you're all raised in different faith traditions, so it's cool to me that you can all come together and meld.
Well, I can't say that we have the same beliefs any more than we have the same realities. Every human being they have their own reality, and sometimes we will agree on certain sections of reality. This is consensual reality, and then, you know, in terms of scientific verifiable fact, that's objective reality. And faith, to me, my perception of our collective faith, is very much the same way. We all have our own personal relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
There are some aspects of our faith that we share. But, for instance, one of the other members, they have what they call home church, and this is members here, and then other former members and close friends, and they meet at one another's homes. And I tried that for a while, but the fact that I'm gay is a non-issue here, mm-hmm. as far as being gay. But the fact that I'm the only gay here, kind of, and, you know, in a Christian environment, I feel 100% accepted for who I am in the home church, and I'm welcome to go any time. At the same time, this is such a period of transition with the Christian church in general. I felt like nowhere am I more needed than out there.
Right.
And I believe I have found a home church now for me, which happens to be Trinity Methodist, oddly enough. You know, after all these years, I've gone full circle, and I'm back at the Methodist Church, which is in a period of immense transition, both for acceptance and ordination of LGBT, and with what's going on with Church of the Res coming in to the Methodist Church right now. So that's what I'm doing. But, you know, I'm not saying 100% that I'm going to land there. I've tried the Presbyterians, too. And Metropolitan Community Church, the Spirit of Hope, which is primarily a gay church. And tried that. And so, you know, I just feel like... And, oddly enough, on the same day I was introduced to Jareth Brooke, the same guy took me over to Hope City, which is on 24th Street in Denver. Mm-hmm. They are run by International House of Prayer. And I started going there because they served lunch, and I was living in an abandoned house about five blocks away.
Yeah.
So I started going there, and I really got close to a lot of people there. Not necessarily their theology, not necessarily anything else, and I was actually baptized there in the tank in the prayer room. And I continued to go there. I still have a lot of friends, but their doctrine started getting more and more hostile to gays, or at least that was what I was hearing. It was one or two searing sermons about the latest earthquake or the latest tidal wave or the latest forest fire because another state had ratified that is allowing gay marriage. I had had enough. I'm saying, you know, okay, I've still got my friends here, they're still going to be friends here, but I'm not going to support this doctrine. I feel like I can be of more use elsewhere. And by then, I was established here. You know, it was obvious. I knew where, it wasn't a matter of where the next meal was coming from, it was a matter of where is the next person coming through the door that I need to be there for. It was here, not there. And so I just kept going to prayer meetings. But I still go through there all the time and talk to my friends and even leadership over there. Are close friends of mine, and I realize they're kind of with me, they understand this, that they're kind of between a rock and a hard place. They might agree with me in private, etc., but because of the position they're in, they're having to toe the party line coming down from Grandview. And I just can't do it. I've been down to IHOPU several times with friends, and they do a lot of great work. I want to say this, City Union Mission, Rescue Mission. Rescue Mission is pretty homophobic in many ways, but they still do a lot of great work. There are a lot of people that depend on them, and I support that. I don't have to agree with their doctrine to say, hey, you're helping people that really, really need help. Right. So what can I do to help you do it? It's not a matter.
Generous effort.
It's not a matter of my pride being hurt by that. Because, you know, they're entitled to their opinion. I'm entitled to mine.
Right.
And if I don't, just because I'm helping them in their works of mercy doesn't mean I have to worship the way they do, and I don't have to have the same reality, the same personal contact with God that they have.
Right.
So. That's what this inclusiveness, that's something that we do preach around here is inclusiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is welcome here. And not only Christians, but people of any faith or no faith.
Right.
They are still God's children and they are still welcome in here. As long as they respect others, come on in, have breakfast, have a shower.
I asked that question because I've talked to maybe three or four other communities or people who used to live in communities, Christian communities, so far, and they all disbanded because of ideological differences at one point or another. They would say, oh, one of us became agnostic, and then it just wasn't the same anymore. Like, whatever. So it's interesting to me that you guys are able to have different viewpoints together, but still...
The plot popped up in the morning as an agnostic, or as a Buddhist, or as a, whatever. It would change nothing.
Oh.
Absolutely nothing.
That's great. Let me see if I have any more questions. I have one more. I think that's all I have to ask. Is there anything important to add that I haven't asked you, you can think about?
I want to emphasize in the Catholic worker movement in general. Unlike a lot of charities, etc., we are completely independent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Allison had, you talked to Allison.
Yeah.
If she had emphasized this. There is no, like, central office that is going to be sending us papal bulls and stuff,
right,
saying we've decided that this is the way it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is one of the reasons why what we were discussing about, you know, we are able to allow our differences in faith to unite us, not to separate us. And that is one reason why. We are independent. Holy Family House over on 31st Street, they do things a bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
Karen House in St. Louis does things a bit differently. Theo and Nicole, they had spent several years at the L.A. Catholic Worker. And whereas, you know, we might, even on our busiest day, we'll barely top out serving 100 breakfasts here.
Mm-hmm.
They do that, but 200 on a daily basis there. They're a much larger house. But we all have found our own balance.
Yeah.
And we're constantly making little adjustments here and there. This is one of the coolest things about living here is that, okay, we've got some fairly hard and fast rules, but we are small enough and secure enough in what we do that we can make exceptions to almost any rule. The one rule that absolutely there is never breaking in that is when someone is disrespecting another human being, we will call them out on it. That is not permitted to go on at all. When somebody is threatening someone else, when somebody is being intimidating, when someone is insulting someone else, no. It just, and it's amazing that we don't consider ourselves staff. There is no staff here at all.
Mm-hmm.
There are the people that live here, but we even consider ourselves volunteers because all of this is volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we volunteer to do this,
mm-hmm.
to live our lives this way. Often when this room is full of guests and volunteers and et cetera, the line just completely disappears between us. We are all as one. And whenever something that occurs, like, you know, a disrespectful scenario occurs,
mm-hmm.
it, most often it's one of our guests that is saying, hey, wait, you know, not one of the volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all respect this space so much, and how the space is so important to everyone that comes here that we just don't allow it. You know, it's a matter of, no, we don't call the police, and except in an absolute extreme case, like somebody draws a weapon, or somebody starts throwing punches and is obviously, you know, intoxicated or something,
mm-hmm.
then we don't call the police. We will call the crisis intervention unit in a case like that. But it's almost never do we have to have the authorities intervene. It's something that we work out here, and usually it's not here in this space, it's out in the parking lot or out on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And everybody participates in it. Everybody has been through it enough times to know just what to do in situations like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just see it. You can just see that whenever there is an altercation, the whole room just becomes instantly aware, rearranges itself, and what needs to be done, some nonviolent intervention, is going to take place.
Okay.
So, yeah, I want to emphasize that. And a large charity, well, you know, Hope City 200, et cetera, or other places like Hope Faith or Catholic Charities where they've got hundreds of people in there, or, you know, to even get in, you have to have a meal ticket or an ID and stuff like that. It's impossible for them to do such a thing. We know almost everyone that comes through that door on a first-name basis. We know their story, and we would not want to grow any larger because we would lose that personal contact, that intimacy with our guests, which is what makes this work. Mm-hmm. It's not that we always have enough food. It's not that we have good coffee. It's not that we have clean clothes and clean showers. Mm-hmm. It's this intimacy we feel with our guests that makes this really, really work.
I went to one of your Thursday night dinners when I was living with Urban Farming Guys. And you're exactly, I mean, I couldn't tell who was a guest and who lived here. And that's wonderful. Because I've been to, I mean, even the practice of like going to a food bank, because I've been to a food bank before, you feel kind of dehumanized. But then coming in here, that was a different kind of charity work. So.
And I'll emphasize again, these other charities, they do great work. They do things that we cannot do because of our size. Our philosophy is, if there was a need, instead of us trying to grow Charlotte larger, instead have another house someplace, you know, that can do the same thing that we do or something similar. There are people just like I did that every morning we'll walk 50 blocks, 100 blocks to get here, you know. And I've turned a lot of people on to Charlotte Brook, just like it was word of mouth that got me here.
Yeah.
I've told a lot of my friends who are now telling their friends. It's probably sixth, seventh generation by now.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them come once, some of them are regulars. Some of them have become so regular that, you know, they've got into this and eventually have gotten SSI or, you know, or whatever, gotten jobs, gotten off the street. I can name probably two dozen what I consider personal success stories that, hey, I remember when I saw you up on Main Street and told you to come in for breakfast. You were hungry. And now they're doing great. But at the same time, we do have our failures. And just last winter, we lost three dear friends. One died in an abandoned house of an overdose. One died in an abandoned house. She froze to death. And one was beaten to death right around the corner with the money in his pocket. And he had a home. He was almost on his doorstep when this happened. I will not say that we don't pay a price.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in an emotional burnout. I can work all day and just, you know, physical work, I'm getting stronger every day with it.
Mm-hmm.
But that emotional jolt that you get from some, you know, continuously people coming through that door with that look in their eyes saying, I don't know what else to do now. I'm in trouble, help me.
Mm-hmm.
We do take retreats. We take personal Sabbath days just to talk to God about this. We take retreats as a community. Like week before last, we went up to the monastery in Atchison and spent two nights in what we call a play retreat. It was just for us to chill out with each other and put this, you know, on the back burner.
Yeah.
And get our balance back.
Mm-hmm.
So we're well aware, you know, the experience has taught us if we don't do this, eventually we will burn out on it. And we won't be at peak efficiency.
Right.
You know, which is when we're open, we have to be.
Mm-hmm.
We can run Charlotte Brook with four people. There's four people volunteering, which
mm-hmm.
is insane if you have 50, 60 people coming in,
yeah.
wanting showers, wanting clothes, and so we can do that. But optimal is about eight
mm-hmm.
to ten. But often we have more. Often
mm-hmm.
we have to turn volunteers away. And that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
When these people, you know, there's a foot of snow and somebody's trudged 50 blocks through it to come here and knock on the door and ask if we need a volunteer. Yeah. Wow. That speaks volumes about the success of this model of charity.
Yeah, it does.
And hospitality.
All right. Anything else to add before I turn off the recording?
I believe that's it.
Okay.